Hi, everybody. I'm Casey. I'm an alcoholic. Whew, I have no idea why I said yes to this. This is about the least favorite thing that I do. I'm a great audience member, but I'm not really keen on being the speaker one of these speakers. But I really do appreciate the opportunity because I know that God's going to use this for God's benefit, I hope, if I can stay out of the way long enough for that talk to be given. I want to thank Jen for the sweet introduction. We were talking at dinner, and I didn't realize how intimidated she was by my home group, which I think is just in a room full of little bunny rabbits and all that stuff, but apparently there was some sobriety in there. But thanks. It's really good to be with you and Tony this weekend. When we were doing the sobriety countdown, I was really tempted to lie, because next year is always going to be the better year. And at the end of this month, on the 28th of May, I'll have 33 years. So I wanted to stand up at 33, but then rigorous honesty got a hold of me, and I said, nah, I can't do it. I got to wait, you know. So if anybody's in Louisville, Kentucky, on the 28th of May, it's a Saturday, and that happens to be my home group day, 10 o'clock at St. Paul's Methodist Spiritual Actions. Come and celebrate my birthday with me. I'd love to have you. Okay, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, that's a big question. That's a lot to talk about, especially when you've had 32 and 11 months, who's counting, of sobriety. And it's funny how as I've stayed sober over the years and longer, more of my story, my pre-story, has come back to me. I can remember sitting in the rooms and thinking I didn't have much of a drunkalogue. And unfortunately, a lot of that stuff has come back, and a lot of it has come back from listening to other women sharing in meetings and sharing some of the kind of funny things they did and the not so funny things they did, and also in sponsorship and working with other women and hearing some of the shameful things that they bring into the program that they don't, you know, they just didn't think they'd ever tell anybody about. And it brings back to mind some of the things that I think as a drunk female, you know, it brings all that back. I used to start my talk by starting, you know, I was born in Knoxville, Tennessee, blah, 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 and all that. I grew up in a non-drinking family, but I grew up in a family that was religious, which is not necessarily bad, but also I grew up in a family where my father had a mental illness, and that remained undiagnosed for first 16 years of my life. Really, it was undiagnosed the first 24 years of my life. And he had a breakdown when I was 16. But other than that, so the household was not, I did not see any drinking in my household. But I saw a lot of dysfunction, and I saw a lot of crazy stuff. A lot of depression, and a lot of just unusual behaviors. My mother was, I learned how to be a codependent from my mother. I learned how to take care of burns from my mother. He owes her a great debt of gratitude. Her illness has done a lot of good for him in his lifetime, and I honestly don't think that he's given her enough credit, and it's too late now. My mother passed away last year in July at the age of 89, and just to kind of talk about that just a little bit, through the process of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to make amends to my mother, and after that amends, we had 12 years of continued love. And we became very good friends, and I got back the mother that I drank over not having. Daddy had to die in the meantime to get to that point. I should throw that in a way, because that really freed her up from taking care of him. But the program of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that 12 years of the relationship with my mother, and I will always be grateful for that. And I'm also grateful for the fact that When she passed away, everything was so clean. Everything was clean. You know, we'd had a great time. It was time for her to go, and everything was good. It was just good. And, you know, 2 years prior to that, I wasn't ready for it, but God gives us what we need to get ready for that. And her, I was ready for that. But this program gave that to me, because through that process of living in that household that was so crazy growing up, the only thing that I wanted to do in that household was get away from it. That was my primary purpose at that point in time. My primary purpose was to get out of here, period. I didn't care where I was going. I graduated high school at age 18, like most of us do, and I went away to college. And when I was deciding where I was going to go to college, and I had started drinking in high school. I started drinking when I was 16 years old, and I'll get back to that in a second. But when I decided to go to college, I had three criteria for going to college. One, it had to be 250 miles or more away from home, because I didn't want anybody dropping in on me, because I had plans. Two, the drinking age had to be 18, because I was. And three, the population on the campus had to be as close to 50-50 male to female as I could get it. Okay? After I found that one college in North Carolina that fit all that criteria, then I had to try to figure out what I was going to major in, because I really didn't care what I was going to major in. I was just trying to get out of that house and move away, because I was suicidal. I was not wanting to stick around. The only thing that saved me from that, when I was about 14 years old, I began that suicidal ideation. I would have these fantasies of jumping out of the car as we were going down the highway. And my hand would go to the door handle. And the only thing that kept me from doing it was I was such an unlucky person. I never win anything, okay? I mean, I never win anything. And I figured, with my luck, I'd jump out of the car and just maim myself. And then I'd be, like, stuck for the rest of my life with my mother and my father taking care of me. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't do that. That is, I got to hang in there. And that was when I was between 14 and 16. And when I got to be 16, I got my wheels. And when I got my wheels, I started cruising the local college campus. And, I got myself a college boyfriend. And the college boyfriend could get booze. And I started drinking. And my life began. And you hear that all the time from the podium. But literally, to this day, as I stand here right now, I can tell you where I was sitting. I can tell you what I was drinking, and I can tell you exactly what that felt like. And it was so magical. So it was just, I can live. I can do this. I can make it through this. And so weekends when I was in high school, I drank, and during the week I didn't, because I couldn't get any alcohol and there was none in the home. Graduated, went to college, flunked out of college because I was drinking a little bit over there, because the age was 18 and I had managed to find all the watering holes, so I flunked out. And long story short, I went to Gatlinburg for a while, lived there a couple of years, got turned on to pot, did a lot of smoking of that, anything that was coming around, pretty much. So that was my pre-drinking, or 16 to 21, and then I moved to Louisville. And I moved to Louisville, Kentucky, and I was old enough to drink, and so I stopped smoking the pot, and I began to just drink. Mostly because it was legal, and I was afraid of getting caught with the marijuana. I don't know that would have been my drug of choice, but I sure liked it a lot. I liked it a lot. I don't know if there are any other pot smokers out there, but good, Jen, good one. I grew up in the late 60s. I am still a very proud card-carrying hippie. We did age out, but we're still, we're still, you're hippie till you die. You know, you're not going to give up on that. And so pot and all that stuff was really very, very popular at that time. And I took full advantage of everything that we had going on there. I did move to Louisville, Kentucky, because Gatlinburg dries up in the winter. At that time, dried up in the winter time, and I was going nowhere fast. And I thought, well, I'll move to a big city. I'm not going to Knoxville because that's where my family's from. And again, I don't want to be too close to home because if I get arrested, I don't want it in the papers there. So, for smoking pot or whatever. So I moved. I had a very scientific way of figuring out where I was going to move to. It was either going to be Charlotte, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, or Louisville, Kentucky. And I moved to Louisville, Kentucky because I had friends that were moving back up there, and they said I could live with them. So I moved to Louisville when I was 21 years old. And so I started working in bars. So I was a cocktail waitress for a while. Well, I got tired of having to ask the bartender for drinks. And so I thought, well, the best way to do that, to get around that, is I'll just become the bartender. And then I'll be in charge of the drinks. And then I can decide when it's time for me to have a drink and who else can have a drink and all of that. And so that's what I did. And I had never tended bar before, and I lied my teeth out. They asked me, are you a bartender? I said, yes. Do you know how to mix drinks? Of course I do. I'm a bartender. Yes, of course, of course. And I didn't have any idea. I mean, just the highballs I could do, but the first day that somebody orders a pink lady or something like that, and I'm thinking, oh God, this is not going to be good. So I'm on the phone calling friends on how to mix these drinks. But anyway, so my drinking career took off at that point, and I was drinking, tending bar, and then going places afterwards, and doing a lot of driving. I don't know, when I think about blackouts early on, I don't know that I had a lot of blackouts, long-term ones, but I would wake up in the morning and not remember how I got home. And I remember it finally struck me that must have been a blackout, because nobody else drove me home. That had to have been me. And I would go to the window to my apartment. I lived alone. And I would look out, the parking lot was right outside the window. And I would look out in the parking lot to see if my car was there, because I didn't remember driving home. And I thought, how'd I get home? Did somebody drive me home and my car's parked in a bar or something? Where is it? And it would be sitting there. And then I would go outside and I would look at the front of the car to make sure there wasn't anything on the front, either animal or human or whatever, because I did not remember driving home at all. And I did that over and over and over and over again. I was a daily drinker. I worked 6 days a week and I drank seven. On Sunday, I rested and drank at home. But tending bar was a very economical way to be an alcoholic. There's a camaraderie amongst those of you who've been a bartender. You know what I'm talking about. The first drink is rung up and the last drink is rung up and everything in between is not rung up. And so it was very economical for me to be a bartender and to drink in different bars and have that fellowship. I had a fellowship at that point with alcoholics, but it was a completely different fellowship. So anyway, so I'm tooling along and I'm tending bar, and I'm about 26 years old at this point, and I've been there about 4 or 5 years, and I'm getting really sick and I'm having some problems and I don't know what's wrong with me, and I go to a doctor and he asks me a bunch of questions and doesn't run any tests and gives me some Valium and sends me home. And I didn't fill that prescription. I didn't want any Valium. So I went to a second doctor and same thing happened. Yeah, it was really very funny. The same thing happened. He really didn't ask me very many questions, and certainly didn't ask me about my drinking. not that I would have been honest about it, but really didn't ask me about my drinking, and decided that I was just a nervous female, and wrote me a prescription for Valium and sent me home. And so at that point I said, well, screw it, I'm not going back to any doctors. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm not going back to any of them. They're just trying to give me pills. And I can't drink and take Valium at the same time, because Karen Ann Quinlan did that and she ended up in a coma. And I can't do that because, again, I'm back to mom and dad are going to have to take care of me because now I'm a vegetable. So, okay, so that's how I was thinking about all of that. So I had to just stay with my drinking, and I couldn't do the Valium. So finally, these two people that I was working with, and I worked at a Holiday Inn, and they said, well, you need to go see our doctor. He's really good. You'll really like him. He's very thorough, blah, 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 blah. And I said, no, I'm not going to any more doctors. All they do is give you prescriptions for Valium. They said, no, you got to go see Dr. Brady. You got to go see Dr. Brady. And they wouldn't leave it alone. And so I called and made the appointment. I said, where's his office? And they said, Dixie Highway. Well, that's about 20 miles west of where I lived and worked. And I said, I'm not driving all the way out to Dixie Highway. That's ridiculous. And they said, no, you got to do this. You got to go. So I did. And I drove out there, and I walk in, and this really cute guy walks into the examining room, and had a swoopy, kind of little swoopy hair, and it's down to about right here, and starting to gray out a little bit at the temples, and a little bit auburn hair, and all that, you know. And I'm thinking, he's pretty cute, you know. So he examines me and does all this stuff, and says, okay, I want to. He leaves the room, and they took me into his office, and I'm sitting there, and I'm waiting for him to come in to tell me what he thinks is wrong. And I'm looking, and sitting right on the desk is a picture of him and his kids, and I'm thinking, he's married. Great. Great. This was a keeper. He's married. So I thought, oh, well, never mind. So he walks in and tells me he thinks that I'm I think the term you used was pre-diabetic. And he was the first person to ever say that to me. And there was diabetes on both sides of my family, so it was not a big surprise to me that I might be diabetic. And, of course, all the drinking that I was doing was not helping with the diabetes. But anyway, so I looked at him and said, okay, well, what do I have to do? Am I going to die? And he said, no, you're not going to die. And so he put me in the hospital to run some tests. Well, anyway, long story short, that was in January of 1976. And he sent me home from the hospital and said, you can't drink because you're diabetic, and diabetics aren't supposed to drink. So you got to stop drinking. You got to watch your diet. You got to do that. I wasn't on insulin yet. You got to do the blah, 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 blah. And I said, okay, I'm a rule follower to some extent. So I'll go home and I'm doing that. I'm not drinking. I'm drinking the heck out of coffee. I'm smoking cigarettes. I go from a pack a day up to two packs a day, and I'm drinking enough coffee to kill a horse. And I'm mad, and I'm irritable, and I'm restless, and I'm discontented, but I'm not drinking. And this goes on until May of that year. And May of that year is, if you all don't know, tomorrow is the Kentucky Derby in Louisville. And that's a big deal in Louisville. That's like Mardi Gras for Louisville. And so I'm working at the bar, and after I got off at 2 a.m., the owner of the hotel that we worked in owned another hotel out on 65, and he said, everybody who works here can go over and have breakfast. So we went over, and I'm sitting there having breakfast, and I can just, there's just a straight line under the bar, and I see Dr. Brady, and he's sitting there with these two other people. There's just the three of them in this little kind of half moon booth. I remember that. And I said to my friends who had sent me to him, I said, there's Dr. Brady. Let's go over and say hello. And they said, no, we don't want to do that. Don't bother him. It's, you know, he's with somebody. Just leave him alone. I said, let's go over and say hello. It won't hurt anything. So I go cruising over there, and I walked up to him, and I said, they're sitting at the table, and I said, hi, Dr. Brady. This is Casey. Remember me? I'm one of your patients. And he looks up at me and he goes, who are you? I said, I'm one of your patients. He goes, oh, you want to dance? And I said, no, I don't. He said, well, why not? And I said, well, because you're married, and I don't think your wife would appreciate it if I danced with you. And he said, oh, hell, he said, we're getting a divorce. And I said, well, come on then. Let's go. And we danced. Yes, we did. We danced. And I won't go into the whole story of that evening, but it's very entertaining. I might should do that, but we do have a limited amount of time. But he was very funny that night, and he was very drunk. And I was very sober because, of course, I was not drinking at the time. So I drove him home. So that was on Derby Eve of 1976, and this is Derby Eve of 2006. And if I had known then what was in store, I never would have believed it. I never would have believed it. So we, I hadn't even put that together, but yeah, this is Derby Eve. He made a date with me the next morning. It was too late to drive home. Let's just put it that way. And he stood me up. He didn't show. He called me, gave me some stupid excuse like having to go to Bowling Green or something, which I now know and was a total lie. He was hungover. He couldn't go out on a date on Sunday, the day after Derby. Are you kidding me? People can't walk in Louisville. Well, alcoholics, practicing alcoholics can't walk in Louisville on the day after Derby. It's, forget it. And it's like our New Year's Eve. And so anyway, long story short, we went out the next weekend, and then we ended up dating for a little bit after that, and then come Memorial Day, which is my birthday, the 28th now is my recovery birthday, but Memorial Day weekend, we go to Florida. I fly down to Florida and meet him down there, and he says to me on the way back, we had a super time. We had a really great time. I mean, when I met him, it just, everything clicked. It was just one of those things where you just know it, you know? You just do know it, you know, for better or for worse and all the crazy in between. And there's been a lot of crazy in between, but we just knew it. We both knew it. It was weird. It was just strange how that happened. But on the way back, he said, well, you know, we're not going to be able to date during the week because I'm a doctor and I've got to be at my office in the morning and you're a bartender and you work at night and I can't sit at the bar all night long waiting for you to get off and blah, 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 blah. And I said, okay, I got it. And so he drives me to my job when we get back to town. And he's driving a white Corvette at this point with a powder blue interior. And he's got a set of golf clubs and his suitcase, my suitcase, and it ain't all gonna fit in that Corvette. So Clever over here decides he's gonna store his bag in his golf bag. He's gonna take me to my job with my bag, go back to the airport, get his stuff, take it to his apartment, come back to my work, pick me up, and take me home. Well, by the time all that transpired, it was late. And so he stayed the night. But he said, but now after this, mind you, after this, we are not gonna be able to do this. Except on weekends. I'm still waiting for him to leave. We have not been apart since. And that trip to get to Florida also is an important piece of my story, even though I'm kind of waxing eloquent about our relationship. But we went out to dinner the first night I got there. He'd already been down there playing golf with some buddies, and I came in on the back side of that trip. And so we're sitting there getting ready to have dinner, and he says to me, what do you want to drink? And I said, well, I'll have coffee or tea or something like that. He said, no. He said, what are you going to have to drink? Something from the bar. And I looked at him, and I said, I don't drink. And he said, why don't you drink? I said, because you told me not to. He said, why did I tell you that? I'm serious. I was sober when I heard that. I am deadly serious. Why did I tell you that? And I had to explain to my doctor why I was not supposed to drink. And he said, oh, you misunderstood me. I said you have to watch how much you drink. I loved him. Immediately fell in love with this. And it took me a long time in recovery, many, many, many years in recovery and thinking about it and going over it in my mind, to realize that at that moment in time, I turned my drinking over to him. He became my higher power, and that's been a problem for me anyway, because he's kind of intense, and he's kind of dynamic and all that stuff, and he's really, really smart, and he usually knows the answers to a lot of things, and so it was real easy for me to just follow his lead, and that was one lead that I really wanted to follow. So at that point in time, I decided that if I drank too much, he would tell me, because he's the doctor. So I let him monitor how much I drank, and at that point, my drinking took off again after 5 months. And I drank almost drink for drink with him, very, very close. Toward the end of the evening, he'd get a little bit ahead of me, but for the most part, I could put away a lot of scotch and water. At the end of our drinking, I was leaving out the water, and it was just the scotch on the rocks. It was just straight scotch. But we did that for about 4 years. It was 1970s. No, 2 years. We did that for about 2 years. And then he got really, really sick. And you'll hear his story tomorrow night. And he ended up going to treatment. And when he went to treatment, I was told that I needed to stop drinking in order to support him. And so I quit again. And my last drink was in... Actually, the end of December, I think it was weekend before, or week between New Year, Christmas and New Year's of 1978. It was my last drink. But I did not give up some of my mood-altering chemicals. I stopped drinking, then I developed migraine headaches that really necessitated, what was the one I liked? What was that drug I liked? Percocet? Percodan. And so I started drinking that, I started taking that. I did that for over a period of time. I had gotten some from his partner, and so I was able to titrate. But anyway, that's not really a part of my drunk log, but that, I quit for him. I quit drinking for him. I really did. And my codependency just took off like a flash at that point. I really, his sobriety was as important to me as it was to him. And I didn't want to do anything that was going to jeopardize that. It wasn't until 1983 that I was in a situation where I'd been asked to attend a women's conference at St. Simon's Island, Georgia. And it was at that point, I went in as an Al-Anon, which I'd been in for 5 years at that point. I went in and I realized when I heard the women talking, because back in the late 70s in Louisville, you really didn't hear any women talking in meetings. You barely saw women in meetings. And I would go to open meetings with him, and you just didn't hear any women's stories. And I went to this meeting. There were 150 women there. Not all of us were alcoholic. There were some Al-Anons and that sort of thing. And it was when I heard the women talking about the feelings and what happened and the depth of the shame and the humiliation and the guilt about their drinking and all the feelings they'd had up until they drank, never feeling like they fit in, never feeling like they were good enough, just all the common stuff that you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, men and women both. And I remember I was sitting on the back row, which is odd for me because I like to sit up front, and I was sitting on the back row, and I remember the first speaker that night, her name was Lou. And she got up and spoke, and it was as if she just was talking to me. And it wasn't that her story was like my story, but the way she talked about how she felt before she started to drink, how she felt when she started drinking, and then how she felt when the drinking took her, it was just identical. It was spooky. And I remember sitting there, and it was like this tunnel vision effect that I've never had it since then. And I really do think it was a spiritual experience for me that night. Because as I was sitting there, everything from here out was just kind of gray and black and white. And the only thing that was in color was between me and her. And it was just like this tunnel that I was looking down. And I couldn't stop listening and watching her. And it was then that I really knew that I was actually in the wrong program, that I needed to be in AA, because I really did had and still had a drinking problem. So that's when I started my journey in May the 28th of 1983. And I did about 15 years and four sponsors and about maybe halfway fourth steps and fifth steps, and didn't really progress very well in AA, didn't learn a whole lot in AA. I also came along at the time when ACOA was becoming a really big thing, and so I decided I was an adult child of an alcoholic, even though I wasn't. But they seemed to, everything else fit, so I did a lot of that. And I really made a lot of mistakes during that time, but the reason I made that many mistakes is because I didn't have the program. I didn't have a program. I hadn't really worked the steps. I'd never gotten past five, ever. I'd never had a sponsor who would take me past the fifth step. I would finish my fifth step. My first sponsor had me tear it up and flush it down the toilet. The other two, I have no idea what happened to those four steps, but nobody ever took me to six and seven and eight and nine and 10 and 11 and 12. It never happened. And at about 15 years of sobriety, I was about as dry as you could get, and I was crackling. It was bad. It was really bad. I didn't want to drink, but I didn't want to live. And I remember getting up one morning, and I was thinking to myself, I've got to do something different. There has to be something different, because I am miserable. I was mad at God. I was mad at religious people. I was mad at everybody. And as I was feeling all that anger, my good Southern girl was kicking in, and I can't let you see that. I've got to look like I'm doing okay, and I'm happy and joyous and free, and I'm miserable. I mean, I'm back to the suicidal part. And at that point in time, my stepdaughter at that time had a sponsor who she had been working with, and it had done a lot of good with Libby. And I didn't like this woman. I didn't like her sponsor at all. I mean, I thought she was just crazy. I did not like her. But I saw the change in Libby, and I thought, I'm desperate. I've got to do something. And I chose this woman, and I chose her. I asked her, and I was terrified she was going to say no, because she was the last house on the street for me. I didn't see anybody else around that was going to be able to do this. And I asked her, and she graciously said, absolutely, of course. And I began the journey of the 12 steps that I had never had for 15 years. I had just been doing four, you know, one through five, and didn't really have a relationship with the God of my understanding. It was through this process of working with her that I began to realize just how much I had missed out on, and how much damage I had done with a lot of other people. I was sponsoring other women, and I was giving them the same short end of the stick that I had gotten. I wasn't helping anybody, really. I was, you know, when I got into recovery in 1983, I went back to school in 1987, and I studied to become a therapist. And so what I was doing with the people I was sponsoring up until I got with this other lady was I was their therapist. I'd just sit and listen to them and talk and tell them what they needed to do and all that good stuff, but I didn't have any of this program to give away. And so I owe a debt of gratitude to her for taking me through the steps and helping me to come to a situation where I could finally have the God of my understanding and be comfortable with that. I didn't get comfortable with it when I first started. I mean, I knew I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. That was a no-brainer. And I knew that everything between my ears was really unmanageable, and I figured that was the unmanageability of my life. The came to believe, that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity was that was a tough one. And when we got to that, she had me do a little exercise called a God story. And when she told me I was going to have to write this God story, I started crying and I said, I don't want to do that. And she said, why not? And I said, because I don't know who God is and I really don't care. And I certainly don't want to write about it. And she patted me on the back and said, I don't care, do it anyway. And so I did, begrudgingly, I did do that. And it was, actually, that was a very helpful exercise for me to do. And then we did third step prayer after that, and then, of course, 4 and 5. And at the end of my fifth step, I did not have that relief that a lot of people talk about. I don't know if anybody else has had that experience where you've done all this work on your fourth step and you shared it with your sponsor on your fifth step, and the only thing that I felt was just like, well, great, now what? You know, I've got all this stuff sitting here. Here's the wreckage of my past and all that stuff. Now what? And what she did for me was what nobody else had ever done, and she took me immediately to the sixth step. Immediately to the sixth step. She said, I want you to go back and just... She said, I want you to list all the character defects that you found in your fourth step and that we talked about in your fifth step. Just write them down. Just write everything down. I don't care what it's called. Just write it down. And so I wrote them all down. And she said, okay, I want you to... And I took them to her, and she said, okay, I want you to go back through your life for the last 2 weeks, and I want you to think about the times that you've acted out that character defect. And it was amazing because I had acted all of them out. They were all right there in my face. It was such a great exercise to do that because I had associated character defects with my behavior in the past, and that really helped me to bridge that gap between what I did in the past when I was a drinking person and what I had been doing for 15 years as a sober person and did on a daily basis. If I did not know what those character defects were and did not know how to treat those and go through the steps and ask God to remove them. And when we finished that, then we did the seventh step. And there's an interesting thing about the third step and the seventh step prayers. If you read the third step prayer, there's no amen at the end, right, Joanna? The amen doesn't come until the end of the seventh step prayer. And between the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, you're in constant prayer. That is part of the prayer, and she taught me that. And at that point, then I was very willing and ready to go on and do 8 and 9 and then 10, 11, and 12. I'd like to say that I'm a spiritual giant here and that I do 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis and do them really, really well, but I don't. I try to do the 10th step during the day as best I can. It's probably not the best I can, but I, you know, progress, I suppose. The 11th step, I try to do in the morning. At night, it's not as easy a thing for me to do. But the thing about sponsorship is that, in a way, sponsorship leads me back to 10 and 11 a lot of the time when I'm working with other people and I begin to see they're talking to me about their stuff and I'm saying, I'm doing the same thing, of course. Yeah, I need to go back and make an amends for this or that or the other. I don't know if anybody else has had that experience with sponsorship, but sponsorship is, it keeps me between the curbs. I don't think that my program would be worth much if I wasn't sponsoring other women. They're important to me because they keep me in the middle of the program, in the middle of the steps. And they keep me in the 10 and 11, and in 1, 2, and 3. I think I've jumped around a little bit. I haven't talked in a long time. I haven't given my talk in a long time. Like I said, I don't really like speaking publicly, particularly. When I grew up, I had a panic disorder, and I would just flat faint. So the fact that I'm standing here and I've not fainted, which is awesome, because it's really ugly when I do that. It's a whole production. But I haven't done it in a long while because really God, hopefully God's at least given part of this talk. I think I might have stepped in and out of it a little bit, you know, a few times along the way. But I think the most important thing for me is that this program is such a big part of my life that sometimes I don't realize that I'm practicing it, if that makes any sense. It's almost hard to remember what life was like before the program. You know, when I talk, I remember the pain and I remember childhood and I remember all those, all the insecurity, all the I don't fit, blah, 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 all the things that you hear in here. But as far as living on a daily basis, my life is so much better, even on my worst day. It is so much better now than it was when I was drinking or even before I was drinking, because the best thing that's come out of, one of the best things that's come out of this program for me is the fact that I do have a God of my understanding, and it's mine, and I couldn't begin to describe what it is. It's not anything close to what I grew up with. And I struggled with that for a long time. My upbringing kind of was beating me over the head saying, you know, you're going to go to hell if you think that. And I struggled with that for a long time. But the program has given me the opportunity to step away from all that and develop a close relationship with the Spirit of the universe and the God of my understanding. And I appreciate God's help in giving this talk, and I appreciate your attention, and appreciate that you stayed awake. That's awesome. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the weekend, and he'll get up and probably correct my talk tomorrow when he talks. But I'll enjoy getting to know each and every one of you while I'm here for this weekend. Thank you.